Hello and welcome back to the Back of a Band podcast. I'm your host, Charlie Walden, and also journalist and owner of Spy Media, Chesterfield-run media company. I'm asking you today, why are you not watching? Why are you not listening to the Back of a Band podcast?
Oh, don't get all high, Mario Russo. It was your student or Diaz. We put you, son.
We're on Spotify, we're on YouTube, we're on iTunes, we're on Google Podcasts. What are you doing?
I sat down with Rick Astley.
Bought me in your LLC because I'm going to pull pranks on your employees.
Nah, I thought that was my only problem. Like, that's a bit too unrealistic.
Every Friday, me and Joe McGlade chop it up. We have occasional chats about what's going on in the world. Anything you can think of, we're talking about it.
And I was honored to be part of that, man. It was really a lot of fun.
He's always been drunk, man.
Always in a fight.
Would you say you miss being, like, in the field of a journalist?
You know, and maybe it was terrible, I don't know. But, like, I just love it all, really. I get into so many different genres.
We have guests on, occasional guests. We've got, like, we've gone from Cobra Kai actors to journalists across the world. But also, of course, some interesting stories. And most importantly, good laughs.
In fact, one of my favourites, I'm wearing a Cobra Kai even hoodie here.
Yeah.
Don't forget to listen and watch the Back of a Band podcast. Well, welcome back to the Back Bang episode. I'm your host, Charlie Walden. Of course, co-host Joe McGlade. It's my pleasure today to say we're joined by North Norfolk MP Duncan Baker, someone I spoke regularly with during my time in Norfolk. A really nice guy, but also a great local MP as well. Duncan, thank you for joining the podcast.
Well, it's lovely to see you again, Charlie. I'm so glad you're getting on really well with your new role.
Appreciate that. It's great to see you. See you too. I've been doing a lot of research in preparation for this, and I'm really interested to get stuck into where you first got involved in sort of not just politics, but I know your background is business. First of all, talk to me about life growing up in Norfolk and sort of how you got into business first of all.
Well, I was born in Holt in North Norfolk, which many people will know. It's famous for being a beautiful Georgian shopping town and visited by the royal family. Life was very happy. And I ended up, my mother and father got divorced when I was very, very young. And my mother got together with a gentleman who ran a very famous business, which was called Bakers and Larners of Holt. And it was at that time, back in the 1980s, quite a small retailing shop. But over the course of about 25 years or so, it expanded enormously into really quite a unique business, because there aren't many traditional family department stores these days. It was always called Harrods of Holt. It was like a miniature Fortnum and Masons in this little tiny town in North Norfolk. But my stepfather, Michael Baker, who died, and I'm sure we'll come on to that in a moment, he expanded that business to be a real conglomerate. It's about 25 million turnover. When he passed away, and it was operating builders merchants and supermarkets and a department store with about 14 different departments. So I grew up from a very early age with sort of business running through my veins, talking about it around the kitchen table. And at 10 years old, I had a broom in my hand and was sweeping the shop floor to earn 50p an hour to go into my bank account. So I was always had business in my veins, really, Charlie.
I mean, you started very early. I mean, 10 years old. I mean, I first got into my job at 16. I mean, what was that like? I mean, character building, just sweeping floors and a little bit of money and sort of learning the ropes of business as well as at a young age.
It taught you hard work. And I think it prepared you for what I do now, which, of course, was never in the game plan. But if you sort of grow up with that kind of ethos around you, family businesses are hard, hard work. You know, you do it for a lot of love, not always for the money, and it's handed over to the next generation. You don't think of selling it; that's unheard of. It just gets put to one side and built up for the next, you know, for the son or the daughter to inherit. So I had a really, really strong work ethic, and that pretty much carried me through with most things. And when I trained to be a chartered accountant, I wasn't the brightest accountant in the class. That was my wife, which is why I married her. It gave you that hard work ethic to get through the exams and all those sorts of things. And it prepared you for this unwitting role to then become one day the MP, which, of course, is many, many hours and an awful lot of hard work.
Definitely. And obviously, you studied business at Nottingham Trent as well. I mean, how did you go from sort of sweeping floors and then you decided to go to university? What was the process in that?
Well, I had a bit of school in between and went to school in Holt and, you know, enjoyed that. And that was also in Holt at Gresham School. But it was I needed to get out of that environment because it was a very small town and that's all I'd ever known. And so I remember getting my A-level results and I really, really flunked them. I ended up getting a C in computer science when everyone was predicted an A, and it meant I didn't get into Loughborough. And I was absolutely heartbroken. And I can remember my father saying to me, "This will be the best thing that's ever happened to you." And I thought, "Yeah, you mean sod. You know, here I am, you know, crying my eyes out because I haven't got into my university." And he said, "No, everything's always been handed to you on a plate. It's sometimes in life you need to fail. And then when you fail, you can learn how to pick yourself back up again. And you will be going off to Nottingham Trent. You'll be around a far more cosmopolitan mix of people from all different walks of life. And actually, that'll do you the world of good." And of course, he was completely right. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. And it almost was a little bit like growing up on the shop floor, as I did, meeting all different walks of life of people. When you go off to university, you meet different people from all different backgrounds. They're not necessarily people that have gone through the very lucky school that I was allowed to go to. So it was great for me, and I enjoyed it a great deal, and I made lifelong friends who, you know, today can't believe I'm an MP.
You mentioned, I actually watched an interview you did, My Norfolk, My Holt, an hour interview, really enjoyed it. It was a great interview. And you're talking a bit about your university and some of the lessons it may taught you. I mean, how good was it to be in that environment of people and, like I say, different backgrounds and sort of from different sort of levels in life? I mean, how was that experience?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. It was nice to get away from where I grew up. And I don't mean that in any disparaging way at all, but if you had always gone to school in the same town, worked with the same people that you'd grown up around with your dad, and you'd been in that environment all your life, and you're becoming a teenager, or, you know, a little bit older than that, obviously, because you're 18, 19 years old, going off to Nottingham felt like a complete change because it was a big city. And I can remember my first day walking around Nottingham city centre, looking up and thinking, wow, this is what skyscrapers are. Well, you know, that was only because the context was I'd only been used to walking around in a small town. You know, it wasn't like I was in London. I was in Nottingham, but it was just the difference. And that was really, really great. My aunt lived in West Bridgewater, which was very near to Trent Bridge, the cricket ground. And I ended up forging a very close friendship with her, who I never really knew when I was growing up, because I say my parents were divorced when I was very little. And so it was great, you know, from that perspective of getting to go to university in a big city with just a massive variety of people who made lifelong friends with, and meeting new sort of family members. It was absolutely brilliant and I enjoyed it a great deal. But ultimately, when I came to graduate, I came back to my home and you know, carried on and became a chartered accountant.
What was that change like, Duncan, going from, like, you know, like you said, a small town into that massive sea? Like, what was it like? Was it a bit overwhelming at first?
Yeah, it was a little bit, because I'd always lived at home, and then suddenly you were sort of thrust into going away. And it was, in a way, it was quite a difficult time in my life, because my mother was getting divorced for the second time from the man who built up that business in Holt. So I remember packing all my bags and literally packed everything I owned, and it went off to Nottingham. So it was quite a sad time. It was quite a formative time as well. But you made friends with people who were immensely supportive, and you know, you didn't know what you were who you were going to meet or how you were going to get on. But I loved it. I think I thrived. I think people do that in life. They, at different times of their life, they find different grooves of how they get on. Some people might, you know, find it at school. Some people might find it at university. Some people might find it in their work life. I think for me, university was a great experience, it very much helped sort of shape me. And I think I can remember coming home that sort of first time after 2 months of being in Nottingham, you know, Christmas time, obviously. This was the late 1990s. And, you know, my sort of, haircut had changed. I went off to university with curtains. That was always a rage back then, you know, to suddenly a different hairstyle, you know, dressing differently. Like, so it was a good time to just, suddenly be yourself after all those years.
What hairstyle did you come back with, out of curiosity?
Oh, pretty much the same one I've got now. But if you can imagine, it used to be curtains and how it used to be back in the 90s.
I mean, that was quite a shock. I mean, with the friends you made in university, obviously, I can imagine it was sort of different range. The friends with now, are some of them sort of Labour supporters, different sort of parties and stuff? And how do you manage that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, so, you know, made friends with people from all over the country, you know, northern chaps it was nice. People with different religious beliefs and backgrounds as well. And so that was, you know, with different faiths. So that was just amazing to kind of meet such a cosmopolitan bunch of people, because obviously growing up in a small town in North Norfolk, you know, that was totally alien. And I loved that. I think I've always had a thirst for knowledge, and I've always enjoyed people and people's company and learning about other people. So it was a really expansive period in my life, and I enjoyed that a great deal. And those people ultimately I remain friends with forever. And yeah, now we have a sort of university WhatsApp group, and occasionally not that I've had a lot of time in the last 4 years, but occasionally you're able to get back together. And I do got a stick from the Northerners, who are all Labour supporters. So, but that's nice. And, you know, I'd very much like to try and get them all into Parliament and come and see this incredible place where I work, because, you know, nobody at 19 years old who I was friends with would ever have turned around and said, well, one day you'll be a member of Parliament. It just was never, ever something that we talked about, were interested in at all. All that formation happened, you know, probably 10 years later. Those core abilities, working hard, getting on well with people, and wanting to help people, all stand you in good stead to become an MP.
Definitely. And before we move away from university, just out of curiosity, I lived a little bit near Nottingham. I mean, where were some of your favourite spaces to go back then?
Oh, blimey. There was always the vodka bar Revolution. That was pretty good. Templars, I think, was a good one, if I can remember. They had, you know, nightclubs and things. I mean, there's no nightclubs where I came from. So, you know, where I grew up, no nightclubs. So it was just, you know, totally different going out in Nottingham. And of course, you never had any money because you're a student. So, you get all your student loan at the very beginning of university. And of course, you end up spending most of that just on being able to go out and enjoy yourself. But then you go back home to work your socks off in the holidays to just earn enough money to pay to go back again. So it was great fun. But yes, I can remember the nightclubs and the bars and the picture and piano, which seemed to go through a phase of doing up old churches and things like that. So these places are probably, show my age now, probably don't exist anymore, but they were great fun back in the day.
A couple of them do, to be fair. Revolution's still going. You mentioned there was no nightclubs in Hull. I mean, what was that like when you first stepped foot in one? I mean, I remember my first feelings when I went to it, I was like a bit overwhelming. I mean, what was it like when you obviously you come from a small town and then you're in a big city nightclub? What was the first thoughts?
I think it was always the student union bar on a sort of Friday and Saturday night, and then obviously that was going till the early hours. And you know, of course, you were a student at the times. You wake up in the morning thinking, "How on earth did I get home?" But that was part of life, and that's part of being a normal young person growing up. And I think probably, you know, arguably life. You know, what are we talking about? We're talking about quite a few years ago now, aren't we? 25 years ago. Was different to how it is today. But I can remember, yes, I think going to these nightclubs and, you know, just having a great, great time with all these different bunch of people that you've made friends with. And you know, they're moments that will last forever. And I'll always say to my children, you know, go and I think you tend to try to probably rectify the mistakes that you make in your own life with your children's lives. You know, so I should definitely be recommending to my children, go on a gap year and then go off to university. And just don't worry, go and enjoy yourself, you know, mate, because they're just such important formative years of your life.
100%. So as you move back to North Norfolk, Holt specifically, you mentioned Mike Baker there, who was very influential in your life, and I watched your maiden speech and you touching tribute to him at the end as well, showing how much care you had for him as well, and how much he had for you. I mean, obviously there was a part you mentioned there. There was obviously the divorce. I mean, how did you first come back in contact with Mike?
Oh well, it was a very difficult time. It was a very acrimonious divorce. It was a very small town, as we keep saying. Everyone knew each other's business, and it was a bit of the talk of the town. And I went off to university, and that was that. And when I came back, I didn't talk to him for 8 years, and it was a very, very sad part of my life. I didn't like that. I didn't enjoy that, and I wanted to change it. And when I met my wife, when I graduated and started my job training as an accountant. And of course, you know, obviously she wasn't my wife at that time, but you know, you talk about your family, you talk about your upbringing, you talk about the people who formed so much of your life, and we, you know, talk about Michael. And she said, but you don't see him. And I said, well, I know it's very painful, but this is what happens in very difficult, acrimonious divorces. And I decided when I qualified as a chartered accountant and I was financially independent with Nina as well, that I would one day go back and knock on his door and say hello to him again. And you know, it was a pretty brave thing to do, but I did. And the mark of the guy is he opened the door. He still had pictures of me beside his bed, and he said, the bed's been made for you for a long time. I knew one day you'd come back. And I think that's the mark of an incredible man, that you know, he although he wasn't my flesh and blood, he brought me up for 18 years of my life. There was a period where we were separated, but I came back. And you know, I think that was amazing that he did that. And ultimately, a few years later, we were so close that he asked me to come and work for him. And that was the unwitting step that pushed me towards politics, although I never quite realized it at the time. But he was a remarkable man, and you know, he had huge influence on my life. He was very different to me in many, many regards. You know, he had certain skills that I don't have, and I think I probably had certain skills that he didn't have. But I respected him a great deal, and I knew that if he wasn't running Baker's & Lahns anymore, it wasn't the place that I wanted to be. And that kind of coincided with this unwitting journey to go into politics. And sometimes in life, things just click. And I had said to him before he died that I would run for Parliament. And the sad thing is that he had tried twice and failed. And he died 5 months before I was elected. And that was why I stood there in my maiden speech, wearing his shoes, wearing his watch as a piece of him that day, obviously in tears by the end of the speech, because I'm sure he was looking down, but he didn't live, you know, just by 5 months, he didn't live long enough to see me get to Parliament. And I, you know, that is a terrible shame. Quite what he had made the last few years, I don't know, but it was a terrible, terrible shame that that man who gave so much inspiration to me never quite got to see me fulfill the ambition that he wanted. But I know from his friends and people before he died had said that he was incredibly proud of me. So it was a very touching moment.
Would you say you were the main reason, Duncan, that you got into politics and ran for Parliament?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, this is probably about 2014. He was quite a leading light in the area for the United Kingdom Independence Party. And, you know, people thought he was absolutely mad, Joe. I mean, people thought he was vilified. You know, people thought he was insane for saying that we should leave the European Union. He didn't do it for any other reason than that he wanted the sovereignty of his country back. He wanted independence from the European Union, not because he didn't like Europeans, he just didn't feel that we should be in political union with Europe. And he used to say, I want to have that sovereignty back for my grandchildren, you know, my children today. Yet when he came out with all this stuff, because he was such a well-known business figure in the area, you know, there was a lot of people that had sympathy with him, but there was a lot of people that didn't. And, you know, you can remember that time. It was controversial, to say the least. But he believed in it. And despite some of the vilification, he stuck to his principles. And ultimately, he was right. We did win the 2016 referendum. He was vindicated for his beliefs because the majority of the country believed what he believed. It was a hard lesson for me to sort of see what big boys politics was all about, to see how he was treated. But you know, don't forget, in 2015, the irony is, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you tonight if he hadn't got 8,000 votes for UKIP at the general election. 8,000 votes is a lot of votes, you know, for a minority party. And ultimately, he took so many votes away from the Conservative candidate that Norman Lamb just won the election with a 4,000 majority. Well, had my father not stood, then Norman Lamb would have probably not won, because the Conservative candidate would have got most of those 8,000 votes. So the irony is, he, in effect, by standing, meant that I'm here tonight, because had he not stood, I reckon the Conservative would have won and I wouldn't be here. So it was an amazing period of time in life, and it kind of got me excited about politics, because I would support him. And there was a genuine 2015. He was, you know, he's thinking to himself on the night of the election, I could end up as an MP. And I think you are. Don't think you are. The figures aren't quite as good as that, but that was still quite a big thing. There won't be many people around the country in 2015 who were UKIP candidates who got 8,000 votes. That's a lot of votes. So he got them because he was so well known and he was so passionate about what he believed in. And I can remember the morning after the referendum, ringing him and saying, "Where are you?" You know, because it was sort of he'd just put his life and soul into leaving the European Union. And he said, I'm sitting in bed with granny drinking champagne at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, he said, my life's work is complete. I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. So, you know, just you sort of forget all these things, because they're nearly 10 years ago now. But yeah, it was a big moment.
Wow. I mean, that's a great story, Duncan. I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, one of the quotes you always talk about, which I really like as well, is one that Mike told you, is when you finish at five and the lights go off, you don't go home. You go into the community and help people. You help out with fundraisers. I mean, how much of hearing that advice has that stuck with you going forward in your life and in politics as well?
Yeah, well, that's an absolutely true story. I went to work for him, and that's what he said. He looked at the light switch on the side of my office wall, and he said, "You see that, Duncan?" I said, "Yes, Dad." He said, "That's a light switch." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, when you go home, you switch it off, but you're not going home. You're going back out to go and help people." And that's what he had done for many, many years in that area, in that community. And that's why he was so popular, because he'd given so much time to other people. And he said, this community supports this business, we support the community that have supported us. And you know, look how many businesses are there up and down the street, so that just, you know, switch lights off at five and go home. Yeah, that's what they do. But he believed in helping people. And he said, I want you to join the Chamber of Trade. I want you to go and rattle the buckets for the Christmas Lights Committee to raise money for charity. I want you to go and join the youth club that he had helped set up. And he said, I think you should get yourself onto the town council, because then you can really see what's going on and help people around the town. And, you know, most people would have gone, you must be joking. I'm going, oh, I've done my day's work. But I said, no, OK, that's what you employed me to do. That's fine. I'll go and do that. And my wife is amazing that she actually said, yeah, OK, that's, you know, that's what he wants you to do. You can go and do that. Yeah, so I was living this life of coming home at 10 o'clock every night anyway, so it's no different being an MP now. I was always doing stuff outside of work, and working long hours and working hard and dealing with different groups and people in the community. I was just doing it around Holt. So becoming the MP is just an expansion of what I was doing anyway, in my view. But I did that. And 2009, July 2009, I stood as a young 29-year-old on the town council, and I won, beat a couple of others, I think, to get the to be elected. And I sat there for about 6 years and didn't say a great deal. I just listened and learned and watched. And that was my first foray into sort of politics, as sitting on the town council. And I can remember after 10 to 12 years of being at the shop and the business, I can remember Dad coming back in my room one night, and he said, you know, remember I told you all those years ago that, you know, I want you to get involved with different community groups and help the area? And I said, yes. He said, I think you took that a bit literally, because you do more for everybody else than you do for your own family. But that was a bit me taking it rather literally.
When did you decide you wanted to switch from the UKIP party to the Conservative? And I remember you telling, I've heard a story of you telling Mike about when you made the decision. When in your head did you decide that that was a decision you wanted to do?
Well, it was after the referendum. So it was, I think it was sort of officially in 2017, the referendum was in 2016. It might have even been pretty much after the referendum. And I remember saying to him, I said, listen, look, I've helped you for the last 2 or 3 years. You've got what you wanted with us leaving the European Union. I've enjoyed this. But, you know, this isn't really me. I think if I want to do this as a longer term ambition, and I'm not talking about Parliament, I'm talking about district council, then I really need to join proper grown up party, and UKIP's not, that isn't for me. And he was really upset. He was really upset at that comment, you know, and because he had, you know, been in different political parties, but he was so independently minded. He didn't really like working cohesively with everybody else, which you have to do in a political party. He wanted to be the train driver of his own train. And but I said, look, you know, come on, I've supported you. I've respected what you wanted. Now you're going to have to respect what I want. And I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go and join the Conservative Party. And that was a kind of a bit of a turning point, because, you know, doing as you're told as a stepson, you know, and then you turn around to your dad and say, no, I'm not going to do what you want me to do anymore. I'm going to do what I want to do, is a bit of a turning point for most sons. And I think that was quite a pivotal moment. And I did do that. And sort of the rest is a little bit of history, because in 2017, there was a by-election and I won that and became a district councillor, and, you know, sort of was able to go back and said, look, you know, I knew it was the right thing to do. And it kind of all went from there.
What was his reaction when you told him you wanted to be an MP?
Oh, well, it was a funny night. Okay, so it was, I can remember exactly when it was. It was the night of, I think it was either Heathrow or Gatwick. There was some, people were flying drones and it was grounding all the planes. And I had said to him, I'm coming up after work, I'm coming around to your house, I need to talk to you. And it was, you know, yeah, all right, well, I'll see you later. And I got around, and 6 o'clock news came on, and he'd sit and watch the news. And of course, there was lots going on because of these drones. And he was very, very interested to watch the news that night. And I kept saying, look, I need to talk to you. Yes, talk to me when the news is finished. You know, it gets to 6:30. And I just, in the end, I said, I'm leaving the company. And that made him focus. And he said, what? And I said, I want to run to become an MP. And he said, you're mad. And I said, well, no, I'm not. You've done it yourself. And he said, yes, but if you win, you'll lose your job. And I said, yeah, that's kind of how it works. So I better not lose. And at that point, my stepmother came through from the kitchen, because she had overheard this conversation, and she said, what did you just say? You're leaving. And I said, yeah, I'm going to try to run for Parliament. So I might not win, but if I do, I will have to leave. And they just sort of looked at me gobsmacked, really. So I think it was a big shock, a big shock at the time. And he was probably a bit upset because he'd obviously invested a lot of time and effort into me. But yeah, you know, I was, you know, just growing up in my own with my own ambitions. I didn't feel that my place was forever more at the company. And, you know, people had turned around to me and said that we think you've got what it takes to become the Member of Parliament for this area. And that's a huge, you know, that's a very, very, you know, kind, that's not wrong sort of word, humbling experience for people to say that to you. And a special experience. And of course, you know, you don't just rock up and become an MP. There's a huge process to it, you know, getting selected by your association, let alone winning a general election. So there was a, you know, huge amount to do. But it was the fact that I broke the ice and said to him, look, I'm going to try and run for Parliament. Listen, Dad, I'm going to try and run for Parliament. The chances of it actually succeeding and happening are tiny, but you just need to know. And of course, then you have to have all the conversations with the board of directors and all the other things that go on in a company, because, you know, it was a senior position which I was vacating if I had won. So that really started the process. But it all happened very quickly, because obviously, as you can probably remember, late 2018 and all of 2019 sort of dominated by Brexit periods and Theresa May leaving, Boris Johnson coming in, and, you know, the 2019 election, which I won. So, but it, that was how it all started. And it was quite a roller coaster, 2019.
Was you ever nervous about becoming an MP, Duncan?
Yeah, I was nervous about it for two reasons. Number one was my family, very close to my family, especially my wife and my children. They mean a great deal to me. And I think actually that's probably one of the appeals to the constituency, because it is an older area. People love their family. It's a very loyal area. And, you know, I was nervous that, that I wouldn't see my children growing up. And lots of people have said to me how the impact it has on MPs' families, etc. So that made me very nervous. And I was genuinely worried that I was just not going to see them anymore. That made me very nervous. And of course, the obvious thing was just the nervousness of doing a role which you had never encountered before. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't, you know, I wasn't hugely political, as everybody knows. I still don't think I am today. I think I try to just be a decent human being that represents my area, who has conservative values. So when you go into, you sort of foray into the unknown, it naturally makes you nervous. And so for those two reasons, you know, immensely nerve-wracking. But I was very lucky. My wife was incredibly supportive and had always said, listen, if this is what you want to do, I will support you 100%. And she has. And so, you know, it went from there. So like everything in life, if you've got good support around you, and I'm very lucky to have good support, you know, you can overcome most obstacles.
100%. I think, obviously, as you mentioned there, it was a big role at the time, because obviously Sir Norman Lamb was standing down as well after so long as MP. But what was it like filling those shoes, obviously for a different party, but he's still the constituency's MP? What was it like potentially filling those shoes? Obviously an icon in the area, wasn't he, at the time? And still is.
Yes, he was, and I think he is. And you're right, that was a lot of what the comments that I got was, you know, you've got very big shoes to fill. And so I had always set out with a strategy that anybody that stands for public office, I have my utmost respect for, you know, provided they behave in a correct and appropriate manner for the role that it encompasses. And so when I got selected, which I think was about the 1st of February 2019, I then started to go to various events and functions, and I'd bump into Norman and see him around, and, you know, we'd nod. That was about it. I'd see him at various things. And I think I'd seen him at a funeral for a Liberal Democrat councillor who I was very fond of. And Norman looked tired. He looked exhausted. I mean, he hadn't been very well. And you could just feel that, you know, the fight was beginning to go. And I'd see him around at different things. And, you know, always polite and pleasant. But he had a real problem. And his real problem was that that this was a heavy leave area. It was a 59% leave area. And he was hamstrung by the Liberal Democrat approach, which was to basically revoke the referendum and, you know, run on a ticket to just ignore the referendum. I mean, there's one thing that constituents hate more than anything else, and that's an anti-democratic stance. So you were sort of confident because you were heading into a general election thinking that you had basically an 11,000 vote head start, you know, based on, you know, sort of a 60-40 split. And I remember getting a tip-off from the newspaper at the beginning of, it was August bank holiday 2019. I was just buying a car, actually, because my old car had broken down. And I got the tip-off from the newspaper that we're about to announce that Sir Norman Lamb, I think he'd been knighted at the time, maybe not. But anyway, that Norman was standing down. And I remember sitting in the car just thinking, well, I've won then. Because I genuinely, and I don't mean this in a big-headed way, and people, I think, know that I'm not big-headed in a way, but I knew I would beat him because you could clearly see the way that things were going, that people wanted to leave the European Union. I knew my home. I knew it like the back of my hand. I knew how people felt. And they had voted for him. They didn't vote for the Liberal Democrat Party. They voted for Norman Lamb. And you saw that when I had the second biggest swing, 17,000 swing in the country. So we know in North Norfolk, people only voted for Norman Lamb. They didn't vote for Liberal Democrats. Why would they? By my view, they're a bit of a waste of a time party. But because we live in a two-tier society where you either have, you know, a Conservative government or a Labour government, that's just a fact, you know, Reform, Brexit Party, whatever it's going to be, Green parties, they're not going to form a government. And so I knew that I could beat him based on the way the constituency felt. Clearly, I would not have the majority that I've got today. I knew that, but I think I would have beaten him. And I think he knew that too, because he had been hanging on by his fingertips for the last couple of elections. He had a 3,500 majority in 2017. So when the announcement came that he was going to stand down, you know, it was that moment where I remember sort of saying to my wife, looking at my wife and going, this is just going to change our life. This is the moment our lives have changed. I could just get a sense and a feel that, you know, Norman had an enormous career, incredibly successful, 18 and a half years being an MP, which I have enormous respect for. But with the way the Brexit vote had gone, I could tell that it was, you know, this was a once in a generation election. It was a bit of a binary election. It was a rerun of the referendum, and that the seat would probably turn Conservative. So it felt that it was all moving in the right direction.
He was obviously the first Conservative in a long time to have that seat as well. Did it feel like sort of a fresh start in that area for Conservatives? Obviously, he was taking the lead on that.
Massive. The party had been asleep for years, and by returning a Conservative MP, it just refreshed the whole thing. It meant that the MP had an office. It meant that our membership started to rise. It meant that we could start to fund an association properly because people wanted to actually invest in us. People wanted to keep a Conservative MP, so they would fund me. We were starting to have an active social programme. So it absolutely, totally and utterly regenerated everything. And, you know, by contrast, you know, what we would get through the airwaves is that it meant that without Norman, the Liberal Democrat Party had collapsed like a pack of cards. So, you know, all in all, it was pretty good stuff.
What was it like for you, Duncan, to like actually be the first one to win it in years?
Well, it was extraordinary. I can still remember waking up at 1 o'clock in the morning and ringing my my campaign manager, who was down at the count at North Walsham Sports Hall, and saying to him, what has gone wrong? And he said, what do you mean, what's gone wrong? I said, well, I've just looked at the projections And on the BBC website, trust the BBC to get things wrong all the time, it said that it was a 91% Liberal Democrat hold. And I said, I can't believe we've lost all our data. You know, all the door knocking on all our data looks fantastic. And I remember talking to a Lib Dem teller on one of the doors in North Walsham, and he said, when did you knew you'd won? And I said, I never can't taken anything for granted. I've got no idea. He said, we knew you'd won from day one we started door knocking. And I thought that was quite a nice thing to say. He was looking pretty glum. And but I said to my manager, yeah, I can't believe it's all gone so badly wrong. He said, ignore the exit polls. I'm standing here and you have won by an absolute landslide. And I said, really? And I couldn't believe it. I said, how can you tell? He said, the piles that you're racking up are enormous in every single town and village across the constituency. It was an amazing feeling. So I promptly got dressed, got my wife to get dressed. I can't remember what we did with the children. We obviously had someone staying the night to look after them, and jumped in the car. I phoned a couple of mates and said, I've won. And they said, how do you know? I said, I've just been told that we're miles ahead. Because you can tell with a 14,000 majority, you can just tell. If that's a big majority, what on earth a 24,000 majority must look like? But and they all jumped in the car, and they all came down. So it was a hell of a celebration. And you kind of walked in, and it was just like, I mean, you just never, ever get a feeling like that ever again. It was just incredible. And yeah, we did. We won with the second biggest swing in the country. I had the biggest majority in North Norfolk, I think, for 32 years. I can remember just thinking, what am I going to do tomorrow, sort of thing. I had no office, I had no staff, I didn't know where to go. It was just, I had nothing. I had to go into work and say, look, I've won, I'm not coming back. It was just an extraordinary sort of 48 hours. You were just exhausted. I remember going to school the next day to pick up my children. You know, everybody stopping you and saying, wow, you're well done, you've won, sort of thing. The odd Liberal Democrat was a bit upset, but as I said to them, well, this is called democracy. It was one of those moments that you'll just never, ever forget.
That's amazing. As you mentioned, there's the second highest majority. And I remember an interview you did with, obviously, My Heart, as I mentioned before. You mentioned people kept saying, you was on a phone call to a lady. I can't remember what role she was in, but she said to you that she had a pound for every person that said, he's going to be our next MP. She'd be a very rich lady. I mean, when you first heard that, did you actually believe you could actually do this and get to where you are now? And as you mentioned, got such a high majority, the second highest in the country. When you heard that, what was you thinking?
Yeah, that's a true story. So it was Christmas 2018, and I got a call from the town clerk in Holt. And I remember where I was. I was in the storeroom at work where we pack all the parcels for the internet delivery, because we used to sell a lot of Christmas hampers. And the call came in, just said hello to the town clerk. We were doing something together. And she just let slip. She said, oh, if I had a pound for every person that comes in the mayor's office, I'd be a rich lady. They all say you'll be an MP one day. And I said, what?
Just casually.
She said, oh, yeah, everyone thinks you'll be the MP one day. And I said, no one's ever said that to my face. I don't think of myself like that. Where's that all come from? And she said, oh, just what people think. And and that was the real turning point that made me turn around, go home. And that's what that was the night I went home to Nina and said, this is what people think. I'm going to run for Parliament. And that's how it all started. True story.
That's amazing. I mean, it's just how casually you said it. It always makes me laugh when I heard that. The first time I was like, what? when you first started the role as an MP, then what was one of the biggest lessons that you learned right away? It's like, wow, I need to get used to that sort of thing.
Well, I remember when I left work, a lady I worked for was my boss. She said, just be yourself. Don't try to be anything you're not. Just try and be yourself. And I thought they were very, very wise words. And so I have just tried to be myself. I've always just tried to be honest, decent, hardworking, there for everybody, and try to do what I felt was right. And look, it's not easy. You know, everybody will have an opinion. It's, you know, being an MP is, I always think, is not too dissimilar to being an estate agent. When you're an estate agent, you know, everyone, you know, when you go and value someone's house, people always tell you you've got it wrong, and actually it should be a bit more than you think it is. You know, no, my house is not worth $500,000. It's worth 550,000. Yeah, it's that sort of mentality, isn't it? And being an MP is, no matter what you say or do, someone, no, you haven't got that right. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. And you always think, well, there's a reason that we're doing it like this. You know, we can't just do those things that you want to do for whatever reason. It's either the law doesn't permit, or the Treasury doesn't have enough money to do that, whatever it might be. So it's one of those funny roles where, you know, quite rightly, everybody has an opinion, and no one's opinion is wrong. You have to listen to all of those opinions, even if you don't necessarily always agree with those opinions. So I've always tried to be sort of decent, honest, hardworking, but listen to everybody. And it's all of those, I suppose, those lessons I learned from a kid with a broom in my hand at 10 years old on a shop floor, is that hard work, talking to people, listening to people, back then it was customers, but actually giving people the time of day, understanding and listening, which of course, as I went through my career, and of course, you know, worked my way up and was on the shop floor at Christmas time or in the wine department or whatever I was doing, was you know, those were joining the town council, joining the every single committee going in Holt. Each step of the way, they were bedrock foundations of what you learned to be, make you a good MP. And essentially, you know, just being a decent person. And look, you know, we, no one expected the pandemic to come along. And I think that MPs really, really learned who they were when the pandemic started, because if you're a good MP, you work tirelessly to support and help your constituents. And I can remember those were some of the hardest times of my life. You know, you'd wake at six and there was just like 50 emails overnight to deal with, and you wouldn't finish till 10. Your eyes hurt, burn, because you're dealing with so much. It was a really, really hard time.
Duncan, you know, you just mentioned a bit about COVID. Do you think the British public sees government in a different light now after, obviously, after what's everything that's happened?
Well, I think that people think that, you know, this sort of word government means that everything is hugely laid out, and it's an enormous, efficient working machine behind the scenes that deals with everything in a completely coherent and methodical way. And as we've seen, Joe, you know, from the COVID inquiry and the texts that are going backwards and forwards, that, you know, what might look like a sort of, you know, like a swan on the top of the water, you know, looking all serene, but underneath it's the legs are absolutely going 10 to dozen. And I think that kind of epitomizes what we saw at that time, in that, you know, people just did not know. They were having to almost make it up on the hoof. And that wasn't just us, this is every country in the world. And the decisions that ministers and indeed civil servants were helping to form, they didn't know whether they were making the right decision from one minute to the next. And the pressure that must have been on Boris Johnson at the time. I mean, listen, I have always been pretty outspoken. I thought that his behaviour with the parties was absolutely wrong, and I called for him to resign. So in terms of morality and ethical behaviour, as I said right at the beginning, I've always tried to be decent and honest, and I think that it was wrong what he did. I don't take anything away from actually the decision-making that he had to make in those times, which for anybody, you know, to take all the personalities out of it, people having to run the country, and it was an incredibly difficult and pressurised time. And listen, I can remember the May 2021 elections. We swept the board. We did really well. People were happy. We had vaccinated people faster than any other nation on earth. So no one can sit here and say we did a really, really poor job, because effectively their memory isn't serving them properly. We didn't. We did a good job in so many ways. course there were things that weren't done as well as they could have done. Rishi Sunak at the time, people thought he was absolutely fantastic as a chancellor because he had safeguarded people's jobs and roles. And
I can remember his first speech. Sorry to interrupt, Duncan. I can remember his first speech. Everyone was raving about him, if you remember.
Yeah, I remember.
They did. People stood there and went, a star's been born. We just witnessed it. You know, so, you know, we do get carried away with the media narrative and that, you know, how they're portraying everything now is chaos and it was terrible and we did it, dealt with it all really badly. We didn't think that back then. You know, the Labour Party supported us pretty much as on every single thing that we suggested that we did. So there was no opposition at all. And I thought, actually, we did a pretty good job. Of course, there were mistakes around the time. You know, and I can still remember talking to Matt Hancock. Don't forget, again, I was the first MP in the country to say, Mr. Hancock, you should resign for what you have done. And because, again, I thought that was, that in terms of decency, it wasn't the right thing to break the rules as he did and be having an affair with an assistant. But I can still remember him saying that they think they have found a vaccine. And I remember saying, well, how can you be so sure? And he said, well, we just think that we have. We took early decisions, concrete early decisions, to invest in the Oxford vaccine, which did pay off, and the early trial data was showing that it was going to work. Now, people like him made that decision, right? So for all of the mistakes and all of the grief that he has received, don't forget that there were also some very, very good decisions made at that time. So we mustn't, you know, history, we mustn't just wipe all things away because we don't like someone if they're not the flavour of the month at this moment in time. I think that's very unfair the way politics is. Actually, there's a lot of people who gave an enormous amount of time for their country and ultimately did make some good decisions and did save quite literally hundreds of thousands of lives. But I recognise that, you know, big national politics, you know, doesn't really reflect that well on people at the moment, because, you know, it has been a very difficult time for many people. But I think it's important to remember, actually, not all things are always bad. There's been an awful lot of good that has happened over the last few years.
You know, I think you make a good point there, Duncan. I mean, apologies as a journalist, but I always, when I get in debates about politics, I always like to give balance and be like, the government did good things during the pandemic. It was dealt a really bad hand. It was the first year in term and the COVID hits. Matt Hancock gets the worst nightmare of any health secretary could get. They dealt the hand they was given. Yeah. So it's a very tough time. I mean, you mentioned the last year. I mean, what is it like being a Conservative MP in the last year? Because it's been a really tough year for the Conservatives, hasn't it? With obviously Liz Truss, Boris Johnson. I think Rishi's doing really well at the minute. But over the last year with the whole saga that went off, I mean, how have you found it?
Oh, incredibly tough. I mean, I remember my wife saying to me one night, I think it was probably over that kind of balmy weekend where sort of there was another leadership race and Boris Johnson had suddenly come back from into the fore and he was trying to get his 100 nominee backers or whatever. But that was that, you know, that bonkers weekend. And I can remember my wife saying to me, I doubt there's too many MPs out there that work as hard as you. And I felt like saying, look, you know, darling, I know I work my socks off in North Norfolk. And she said, somebody in Downing Street, through their behaviour, can absolutely ruin everything you've worked hard for. And I said, yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, that is soul destroying that you can work so hard. And it doesn't matter who you are. There are fantastic MPs of all different parties. I've said it before, Norman Lamb was a fantastically decent man who worked very, very hard for North Norfolk and he deserved to be the MP for many years. So look, I'm not being partisan about this. But it is a case in point that you can work extremely, extremely hard and if the water is not flowing in the right direction, it doesn't matter. And that's you're out of a job and that's tough. But listen, that's the job. We signed up for it. We opened our eyes and we said we want a bit, so we have to live or die by that. So the answer to your question is, Charlie, it's been extremely difficult at a number of points, a number of times. The irony is that wherever I go in North Norfolk and whoever I talk to, you know, humbling as it is, people are always very positive and say, listen, we know how hard you work for us and whatever happens, we will support you. And so in your first, in 4 years, to sort of get that kind of feedback is lovely. Of course, we don't know whether that will translate to next year when there's a general election, but we hope so. So, but the national situation has been very difficult. And Sunak has come in. Yeah, he is a thoroughly decent, intelligent, considerate, moderate individual. You know, he's the right man for the job to get us through the very, very difficult situation where, you know, inflation is as high as it is, and the cost of living crisis, and all the energy crisis, all those problems. You need somebody who's calm, with a cool head, who's considerate and methodical, and a professional. And he is that person. There's no doubt about it. So, you know, the next year ahead, listen, people think, you know, oh, they go, oh, there's only an election around the corner. It's a year away. If you think what's happened in the last year, it was only really a few weeks ago that the Queen was lying in state in Westminster Hall. That's how long ago a year is in politics. You know, that's a long, long time to go until another general election, as far as I'm concerned. So anything can change, and events, anything can happen. You know, for me, keep doing what you're doing. You've got to keep working extremely hard, putting your constituents first, helping them, supporting them, doing whatever it takes to make sure that North Norfolk is a better place. And the rest of it, you know, you can't do any more. And as long as you look in the mirror and say, I cannot physically do any more, then you've done enough, haven't you?
Definitely. I really do appreciate your honesty on that, Duncan. It was a very honest answer. And as I said to you before, I do believe you are such a dedicated MP to your constituency. When I left the patch, I said that to you, because I generally do mean that. Like, when I was covering the patch, you'd always be doing something. And even your biggest critics in Twitter comments, the Facebook comments, there would always be someone saying, don't always agree with Duncan, but respect him because he works hard. So you can, I definitely agree with that for sure. As we come to an end, because I know you're a busy man, Joe's got some quick five questions. You've got five, haven't you, Joe, to ask.
Great. Go on then.
Sorry, wait, I've got to get them up. What do you think?
Go on,
I didn't like write them all down yet, Phil. I've got them on my iPad behind me.
I've got one then, Joe. I'll let you sort yourself out. I've got one, first of all. It's a bit of a fun question, not politics related or anything like that, as we was on the topic earlier. What's your favourite beverage, alcoholic beverage, Duncan?
Gin and tonic.
Gin and tonic?
Yeah, but I don't drink at the moment because I'm training for marathons, so I've stopped drinking. I feel a hell of a lot better for it. But yeah, you can't beat a nice gin and tonic.
I've just come off of Sober October, and I can't lie, it felt great. It felt great at the end of it. I was like, I'm so proud I got that done.
Good. And non-alcoholic beer is a lot better today than it used to be. So because I love the taste of beer, I'll have non-alcoholic beers. And actually, they're not too bad. But I love the fact that I can get up and I feel as fresh as a daisy. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it is good not to wake up with a sore head or a headache, I must admit. You say you're training for another marathon.
It's the tiredness. I don't drink a lot, but alcohol, you know, it gives you not a terribly good night's sleep, and therefore you feel tired. I mean, this job, you can't afford to be tired. So yeah, but yes, I am. I'm going to try and do my craziest challenge yet, which is two marathons: the London Marathon on the 21st of April, and then the Norfolk Marathon on the 28th of April. So at 44, as I will be,
you're crazy.
When I put my trainers on. Yeah, I know. Hence, I'm training very, very hard, but I'm excited about it because I can raise huge amounts of money for charity, and that's why I do it. And it will be a hell of an achievement to have done it. And I'll run the marathon in London hard, and I'll try and set a time for that. And frankly, the one a week later, if my legs are recovered, I just want to trot round and get round and just do it to say I've done it. But yeah, it's my toughest challenge yet. Hey, some people run a marathon every day for like 7 days. I can't do that, but I'll have a go at doing two marathons in a week.
Big respect. If you send me your fundraising page, I'll put a few quid in it for sure as well. That's crazy.
That's very kind.
Have you got your questions, kind. Joe?
Yeah, one of it. What's your favourite TV show, Duncan?
Oh, okay. I'm a bit of an old school, so things like, you know, Only Fools and Horses and stuff like that. I love a bit of comedy. Faulty Towers, that sort of stuff. Absolutely brilliant. I love all that sort of stuff.
If you had to have one movie actor play your life, and your whole career? Because it's very exciting one. I didn't really realize till I started listening to interviews and you've done and stuff like that. I mean, you've had a really exciting life and a really good life. I mean, who would you like to have playing you as an actor?
Tom Cruise. He's the same height as me.
Good choice. Final one from me. Favorite food?
Shepherd's pie.
Shepherd's pie. Good choice. Classic. Do you have any more, Joe?
If you could sit around the table, Duncan, with three celebrities, who would it be?
Kylie Minogue, Tom Cruise, and Michael Schumacher.
I love Michael that. That is a great one. Michael Schumacher, legend of the year. Have you watched his documentary?
Yes, it's amazing. I still think he's the greatest driver of all time. My stepfather, who passed away, was a huge fan. I was in 1999. I was at the bottom of Cops Corner when he went straight on and broke his legs at the Silverstone Grand Prix. So I saw that happen. It was horrendous. But he was an absolute icon, wasn't he? And he just, his personality as well, I used to love it. You know, he's real. You know, but when he was young, he was real arrogant. Arrogant, wasn't he? But why not? He was the best of the business. So he was great. And obviously Tom Cruise, for all the reasons, he's cool as ice and he's the same height as me. And Kylie Minogue, because quite frankly, she's the most beautiful woman that was ever made.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree, to be honest. Final one, Duncan, and then we'll wrap. What advice would you give to an up-and-coming politician looking to make a career?
Well, probably the same words that were given to me is just be yourself. Be decent, be kind to people, work extremely hard, but care about the constituency. People get sidetracked. They want to become ministers and they want to be, you know, really, you know, all these sorts of things. Listen, I couldn't care about that at all. The most important thing to me is my home, and I care about North Norfolk and my home enormously, and the people that live in it. No matter what, you know, there'll always be 10% of people who give you stick because they just see you as a Conservative MP. Doesn't matter to me. They still deserve as much help and support. And if they were at a time of crisis, and that has happened, you know, where people have given you terrible stick on social media, then emailed you and said, can you help me? And you go, yes, I will. And that's how it should be, because you are there to serve those people. You have an immense privilege with this role. You shouldn't abuse it, and you should use it to make sure that you can better those areas and the people that you represent. You know, that's so, I think that is in a nutshell, is remember the very people that put you there in the first place. And if you focus on that and you represent them well and you work extremely hard, that will shine through. There's no doubt about it. You can't fake who you are. You can't just dip your toe in 6 months before the general election. The elections are won on years of hard work. They're not won on 6 weeks of hard work. So that's my motto to anybody who's trying to do this, is do it for the right reasons and work extremely hard and make sure you represent people. And I always think that actually it's better to represent the area, your home, because, well, I would say that because Norfolk was where I was born, but, you know, I find it a little bit difficult when people represent sort of places they have absolutely no affinity with whatsoever, because, you know, you think, well, why would you suddenly care about Birmingham North because you suddenly moved there 6 months ago? You know, I just think, you know, politics is becoming more and more localized these days. People want representation in their area, really good representation. And so if you focus on that, I think that you can go, you know, you can't go too far wrong, is my view.
Great words, Duncan. And I have to say, it's been an absolute honour to have you on. When I first relaunched the podcast again, you was one of the names on the top of the list to get on, for sure, because of our chats when I was covering Norfolk. So I really appreciate how generous you've been with your time this evening.
Well, that's very kind. I've enjoyed it. It's been lovely. We've covered all sorts of things and some quite personal things as well, which has been nice to share with you. So, look, you've done brilliantly. I've always, you know, you've got your job to do. And when you used to come to me and say, can you come and do an interview? Can you tell me about all that? Yeah, I've always hopefully be the first to say, of course, yeah, I'll come on, help you, you know, because that's what you should do. We've all got a role in life to fulfill. And I like to think that I've helped you, and, you know, and I've always wanted to do that. So no, it's been lovely to see you again. I'm so glad you're getting on well with your new role, and keep in touch. And thank you, genuinely thank you for giving this opportunity for me.
Yeah, they were there, them words mean a lot, Duncan. Appreciate you coming on. If you've liked this episode, subscribe to the channel, or like and leave us a review on Spotify or iTunes as well. Thank you very much, Duncan.